civil rights of people with disabilities. All ADAPT actions are nonviolent.
Us to another episode of So What's Your Story? I almost said on Wednesday night, but welcome to our new time, Thursday night at 8 o'clock. I'm your host, Greg Audell, and along with the team swimming in talent, Drs. Warren Holloman, Mary Edgerton, and Hank Rubicek, our engineer and media relations scout, Tatiana Gago, and of course, Floyd the Wonder Dog, together we bring you great storytellers. Ordinary folks, but with extraordinary and thought-provoking stories to tell, who generally take us on astonishing journeys through the very windows of their soul before bringing us safely back to the present. You know, Oprah said, has a quote I like. She says, "Your real job in life is to figure out what you are called to do. You use a job until you can figure out what that calling is." Well, tonight my guest will share narratives about the way they found themselves. And as storytellers know, there is no better way to document how one finds him or herself than through a story. That internal compass that guides and ultimately points us in the right direction. We hope. And for the two wonderful tellers seated next to me, their personal journeys ended up just fine. Leslie Butcher is a communication instructor at San Jacinto Junior College, one of my favorite schools. My mother worked there for many years. She is a member of the Houston Storytellers Guild, is married to a former rocket scientist, with whom I am told she shares three incredible children. She is obsessed with college basketball and shares my obsession with coffee. And most important, she likes helping people and organizations better understand communication. She is a fellow Moth Houston Story Slam champion. She's been on before, and we are thrilled to have her back on the air tonight. Carissa Baldwin McGinnis is an Episcopalian priest whose interests are social justice and spirituality. I would think those are good interests for a priest. She shares three children, 2 4-year-olds and an 18-year-old. Okay, we got to find out stories about that before the evening's over, with her wife, who is in the oil industry. Leslie and Carissa, welcome to So What's Your Story?
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thanks so much.
I think we're going to have fun tonight. Carissa, you told me you never expected to find yourself in Houston, Texas. So let's start off the show with your story of how you found yourself here.
So I, in part, never expected to find myself in Houston because I'm from Austin. And in fact, all four of my grandparents lived here. So I came here quite frequently in the 70s and early 80s to visit my grandparents and found Houston to be one of the ugliest, filthiest places I had ever seen. So it really would never have occurred to me that I might fast forward a few decades and end up here. But that is what happened. I ended up attending seminary in my hometown and took my first church assignment here in Houston, not far from this radio station at St. Stephen's Episcopal Church in the Montrose.
Such a beautiful church.
Yes. And I've noticed something about Houston. many Houstonians have lived in Houston more than once. You know, they go and they come back and they go again and they come back. And that's, in fact, what happened to me. I took a great church job out in Los Angeles for a couple of years and decided that I'd like to live in the same city as my spouse, so I returned to Houston so that we could start that family. and we did, and we have ended up through the foster and adoptive system with these three beautiful children. and have kind of basically created a Heinz 57 family. We look a lot like Houston. And so that dream of being a parent has come to pass, but I'm not just a parent. I am a priest mom. And so one thing that Houston has posed to me is this question in a particular way of, I know how to do church for my family, but what kind of church do I want uniquely for my family? This Heinz 57 multicultural, transracial, interclass, queer family. Because my own tradition, you don't often walk into an Episcopal church and look at it and think of it as a Heinz 57 kind of place. And what I have learned since starting this family is that the most important thing is to have a community that will love us for who we are, and who will receive love back from us. And what I've also found is that the longer I'm in Houston with my three babies who were born in Houston, and it seems like this is where we're going to stay, is that beyond being loved and being able to love the community, I just keep having this desire for us to walk into our own church and have that church look like us and look like the city of Houston. And so that most recently has called me, in collaboration with Bishop Andy Doyle here in the Episcopal Diocese of Texas, to attempt to start a new church in the Episcopal Diocese, and not out in the suburbs, but right here in the heart of Houston. Something that will look more like my family and look more like this city. I think it's a time, we're trying to do this in a time and a culture that is serving up in our institutions and is serving up in our culture this invitation to separate from each other, to stay in argument with each other. We're being offered all kinds of plates of fear and hate and entrenched opinions. And I think we are being convinced that this is what we want, that this is how we protect ourselves. This is how we keep ourselves safe and serve our best interests. And what the core team for this church plant believes and knows is that the last thing that we want and need is to be separate, that our safety is in our connectedness. And this illusion of cultural walls that can keep us apart is just that. It is an illusion. And so if there's one thing that we're setting out to find or create in Northeast Houston Inner Loop with this church plant, it is the overarching goal of being neighborhood-based and being a spiritual community in motion that guarantees this kind of connectedness, this kind of egalitarianism, where it's easy to be brave. And in being brave, we demonstrate that these cultural walls that we're all perceiving are just not there.
Well, let me ask you, you know, many of the struggles you talked about of wanting to be in the same city as your spouse, you know, that's common among many professions. But was there a moment when you knew that your faith made a difference in your path?
There definitely have been more than one moment that I knew my faith made a difference in my path. The earliest one came back in about 1996. Honestly, years before I entered seminary, I was a new college graduate, very idealistic, working in the human rights industry in Washington, D.C., but also at a time that D.C. was really in crisis. And so there I was, kind of a kid of privilege, in a city that could not govern itself. The federal government had taken over. Welfare reform was going on. It was a culture of fear and hate and incredible poverty, children on the streets. And suddenly my liberal white idealism was not enough for me to make sense of my own reality. And I remembered that the tradition of religion, particularly Christianity and urban Christianity in America, did have a way to make sense and to be part of solutions and invitations to a force more powerful and something better than what I was living.
What would you like our audience to take away from your path in this story?
I would like the audience to take away the importance of friendship, that in the end we build community and we transform community through simple, trusting communication and staying in relationship with the people that we meet and that we care about.
I think we saw that a lot during Hurricane Harvey. You know, it just, the labels fell by the wayside and people were just helping people.
Need is an incredible equalizer. And we were one people in great need at that time. And what we know now is that some people have been made whole and others have not and don't have prospects of being made whole. And this is a going concern for us that we'll want to keep in mind.
Amen.
Yeah.
Now, Leslie, while finding ourselves is an ongoing process in life, your first story reminds us that we gain a lot by watching our friends go through that same challenge and that same process of discovery. Would you share that story with us?
Sure. Well, I was listening to Carissa talk about being an idealist in college, and I think there's part of us that all, why I love teaching in higher ed is that everyone's so hopeful and everybody seems to have dreams that are larger than life. And I was at a faith-based university in Tulsa, Oklahoma, where it was just that. Everybody had these huge dreams, and I had a friend named Ryan who was one of them. And so we would sit in an intro to radio class in a studio a lot like this, and we were in a marketing class. We had mutual friends, so we would hang out together. And one day Ryan needed a job waiting tables and just needed to make money like all college students do. And we got to be really good friends. There was a chain restaurant in Texas and Oklahoma. You may remember Steak and Ales.
Oh, yes.
And so I was waiting tables.
That was high class.
It was very classy.
Effervescence.
If you've waited tables, you know in the behind the scenes, it's not quite as classy as it appears in the front of the house. But Ryan and I started hanging out a lot. And one of the things that I grew up listening to my dad say is, what were you created to do? What are your hopes and dreams? What are you going to do with your life? And so when I went to college, I used to ask people that all the time. And so Ryan and I would hang out and I would ask him. And usually he was in a hurry to get back to the studio, hurry to practice keyboard or guitar. He worked harder than anybody I'd ever met. He was more driven than anyone I'd ever seen. And he began to share this concept of, I believe I was created to write music. I believe I was put on earth to do that. And I'm just not going to look back. And I've never watched anyone just be so confident in their purpose. And so he worked nonstop, and long before American Idol or these America's Got Talent existed, we heard that MTV was doing an open mic contest, and Ryan said, I think I'm gonna enter. And so he did, and these older guys that we all know by the names of Brian McKnight and Lance Bass offered a recording contract to the winner. And my friend Ryan took his acoustic guitar and his song, little love song that he wrote. I have the original, one of the original demos on a Sharpie CD. He won. And the contract, the terms of the contract were a little fuzzy. It kind of fell through, and he ended up coming back to school and not taking that opportunity. And a lot of us looked at him and said, it's really honorable that you want to get your degree, but in this music industry, people don't get a second shot at fame, and you should really run with it. And he came back the next summer. He did an unpaid internship for DreamWorks, and he really did struggle and kind of went through that moment where, how bad do I want this? And kind of resolved that he would write songs, and if he could just make enough money to pay his bills, he'd figure out a way to put together a band. And so he got someone to pay him $50 a pop for jingles in Nashville, and it just started formulating. And we, at the time, social media didn't exist, so I kind of lost track of him, and he graduated and I graduated, but I followed him, and he put together this band, and they went to LA, nearly went broke. They ended up actually going back to Colorado, but he made a friend networking in Nashville, Tennessee, a guy named Timbaland, and Timbaland really said, let me help you. I know that you're gifted. I know that you're talented. What if we redo one of your band songs? This was about 2004. And we'll put it on this compilation album. And so they did. And that song, Apologize, broke records in Australia and in Europe and was played everywhere in America. And I'll never forget walking into a Macy's and hearing it play in the loudspeaker in the store. And I just began to cry. And I thought, oh my gosh, he's really doing it. He's really made it. And hadn't won a Grammy yet. His band really still hadn't gotten huge. And I just remember him saying, I was put on earth to write music. And so I would follow his career kind of on social media. I'd read about him. I'd see friends post things. And about 4 or 5 years ago, I knew that he was up for his first Grammy. And it was for songwriting. He'd written one of Adele's, most of her album. And so I put my kids to bed early. I got my popcorn and my wine. And I said, I'm going to watch him live his dream. And sure enough, he won that year. And then a few years ago, I was sharing with my students last week, Billboard magazine called him the undercover king of pop. That wow. He got to write wow. for Paul McCartney this last year and has written for everybody from Taylor Swift to Adele and Charlie Puth and you name it. And I mentioned this earlier, but this past year we went to the rodeo and his band One Republic was there, and so I took my son and we sat just like normal fans in the middle of thousands of people while the girls next to us looked up his wife on Instagram and said, he's so cute, I wonder if he's married. And I leaned over and I said, he is, and he has two little boys and he's the greatest guy, and he always said this would happen, and I believed him and no one else did. And so it was just a great moment. I cried. My son saw it. And I said, listen, it doesn't really matter if your dream is to be on a stage in front of 50,000 people. What matters is that you figure out what you're created to do and you just pursue it with everything in you. And it really doesn't matter if people believe you. It doesn't matter what it looks like. It just matters what it is. And he was destined to be there. And it was just such a fun moment and fun to get to see that really come about over 17 years.
Wow, I love that. Now, let me ask you, do you think he's surprised by his success?
I think a little bit. You know, it's funny because I just watch interviews of him now online and I'll hear him talking. And he was honestly, and I can say this truthfully, I listened to him say this in an interview. He said, if I could just make $50,000 a year writing music, I'd be happy. And I read last month he's worth, I think, $30 million now. Wow. But really that idea of being actualized that Abraham Maslow talks about in psychology, that he really is just living what he was created to do. I used to joke with him that I wanted to write his biography. And he told a story one time where I said, how do you know that this is worth pursuing? Like, and just like you said, how do you know if you'll make it big? And his dad actually, which is crazy, wrote music for Kathy Lee Gifford back in the day. And he said, my dad used to drive me around and play the radio, and he would make me sing with the radio. And he would say over and over, Ryan, you're that good. Wow. Until I believed it. And I used to say, okay, when I write your biography, we're going to call it You're That Good.
Well, I think having someone believe in you is a huge advantage in trying to go for what you want. And it's funny what you said about his money. Another thing I heard Oprah say about going after your purpose, she thought, when I was 22 years old, I was making $22,000 a year. And I thought if I could just make my age and money, that meant by the time I was 40, I was doing what I wanted to do and I'd be making $40,000 a year. Well, she did a little better than that.
Yeah, she did okay.
She did a little better than that. Wow, that is very encouraging. One of life's rites of passage is that dreaded first job interview. And it's something that is universal, that we all go through, and we all probably have a horror story attached to it. But you've got a story about yours, Leslie. Will you share it with us?
Well, I don't know that I would consider it a horror story, but while I was hanging out with Ryan Tedder of One Republic on the streets of Tulsa, I was I had started my undergraduate career at a little school outside Lexington, Kentucky. I was playing softball. I wanted to be a broadcast journalism major. I wanted to be a sports broadcaster. That was my dream. Some rough things happened emotionally. I lost a friend to a bad car accident. I transferred out my sophomore year to this school in Tulsa, and I quickly learned that there wasn't about what you knew. It was about who you knew. They were all about networking. And I found myself in an organizational interpersonal communication major, completely confused about what I could do with it. And I just needed a plan. I have a professor down the hall from me in her office. She says, "Not all who wander are lost." And I laughed and thought, I haven't wandered a day in my life. I was so driven from the time I was five. I knew that I wanted to be valedictorian. I was in every club. I was a varsity athlete. By the time I hit 19 years old, I was exhausted. I had achieved and done and performed and tried to be the best I could be, partly because I was scared. I was in a big family. My parents didn't have much money. I knew that college was on me. I was trying to work multiple part-time jobs. And I thought, I'm going to graduate college and I'm going to have to take care of myself. And I didn't know what that looked like. And I sat one day in an intro to management class, and we had this adjunct professor who was a vice president of an accounting software company of all things. And he said, "We're going to do something different in class." And he said, "We're going to make 5 and 10 year goals. But before we do," he said, "I want you to go back to your dorm or to your apartment, and I want you to really think." And he said, "For a lot of you, it may involve praying, but," he said, "I want you to ask God for a picture of what he wants to do with your life." And it was really kind of heavy. And I don't know that I haven't personally had a lot of visions in my life, but I really remember at 19 thinking, I'm exhausted and I want to do something that matters. And so I had this image of a bridge, and there were people on a cliff, and I could tell that they wanted to get to another cliff. And I was putting all the pieces in place to create this bridge to get them from where they were to where they wanted to go. And I'll never forget writing these 5 and 10 year goals, thinking, okay, I just want to help people build bridges, and I don't know what that looks like. But when the opportunity presents itself, I'll know. Fast forward a couple years, we had a speaker at the campus who came. She was the most phenomenal communicator I'd ever seen. And I remember thinking, God, I want to meet her. And a few weeks later, I was getting my aerobic points in for my PE class, and I came across a guy who looked really upset. We asked him some questions. We started talking. We ended up going out for coffee, and it turned out to be her son.
Wow.
So he and I built a relationship, and we talked about life. I ended up giving him a ride home to his home outside Chicago, Illinois. I was in Southern Illinois, but I pretended like Chicago was on the way. If you're geographic, you know it's not from Tulsa, Oklahoma. But I just so desperately wanted to meet her. So I stayed at his house, didn't get to meet her, and I didn't know that he was talking to her. And so a little bit later, I was panicking because I thought, I'm a senior. I still don't really know what I'm going to do. I'm working 3 part-time jobs. I'm trying to keep my grades up. And I just kept helping him with things. So he'd ask me to write a paper with him or help him with a project for his brother. And his mom was a pretty well-known national speaker. So they were working on a project where they would help, they were going to put this book together, and his brother was going to write it, but they were going to give it to parents. It was about, if I'm in ministry, how do I raise my kids? And it was written from the kids' perspective. And so I helped with that. And then one day he said, "My mom would like to talk to you." And I'd maybe met her in passing by this point one time, and I was terrified. I thought, what am I going to do? And he said, "She's going to meet you in the parking lot. She doesn't have a lot of time. She'll just come to your car." And I owned a 1993 blue Geo Storm. It was worth about $400. I'm pretty sure she drove an Audi TT convertible. And I was so scared, and scared it was filthy. But she sat in my car, and I'll never forget. She said, "My son's been telling me you've been helping him, and he said you're brilliant." And she said, "Here's the thing. I just have gone through these meetings, and I've had publishers call, and it's like I'm standing on a cliff, and I can see a book on another cliff with my name on it, and I've been looking for someone to build a bridge." And if there ever was writing in the sky, that was that moment. And I got goosebumps, and I said, yes, I'll do that. I didn't know what ghostwriting was. I didn't know it existed. I had to Google it in my dorm that night. But I said yes to whatever that looked like. I didn't know that it would look like moving to California with a suitcase and nothing, or working 80 hours for the next 18 months. But we ended up putting two books in print. But I remember having a moment where I thought, I don't know if I'm qualified to do this. I have a communication degree, not an English degree. And I told the sweetest old lady in our photography department, you're not going to believe I went through this weird interview and I think I said yes to a job that I don't know how to do. And she said, well, hold on just a minute. And she made a phone call and she said, be in front of your dorm tonight at 7:30. And I said, okay. And so I did. And this giant Cadillac pulls up and a woman rolls down the window and says, get in. And I'm 22 and naive and I don't know anything. And so I got in and she took me to a hole-in-the-wall Mexican restaurant. She slid her business card across the table. Her name was Jan Dargett. She just got alumnus of the year at the university I graduated from. She said, I've ghostwritten over 300 books for national speakers you would know, and a lot of them are national bestsellers. You have 1 hour. What do you want to know?
Wow.
And all I remember from that moment was she said, what speaks well doesn't read well, and they won't understand. And so I learned a little bit. She said, you have to kind of become the person. And so that interview led to the coolest 2 years of my life of living up close to a national speaker, getting to write that book and building bridges. And when we got that book, that first book in print, I felt like the bridge was built and it was time to move on. And I went to graduate school and have gotten to spend 11 years just helping students build bridges from junior college to Division I, four-year schools, or to careers, or to businesses. And I still think about that image of a bridge, and my students will tell you in my office I have a bridge. And I said, it doesn't really matter how much money I make. I'll spend the rest of my life helping people get from where they are to where they want to go.
Wow, I love that story. I mean, particularly because it just shows the power of dreaming, of manifesting. And, you know, and a lot of people say dreaming time is wasting time. No, I think that's planning time. I think it's planning time for your soul, your mind, your spirit, and the heavens that be.
Yeah.
And I guarantee you, had you not spent that dreaming time, the opportunity would have passed you by. You wouldn't have ever probably encountered her son. You wouldn't have made anything of it. And, you know, you and your determination made that happen.
Yeah, it's really a combination, I think, of dreaming and hard work. My dad is a dreamer, and he used to tell us as kids, if you feel like you were created to collect belly button lint, just be the best one you can be. I mean, that was sort of his philosophy. I went to a TED Talk event this year with a professor from Rice University, Dr. Sandra Parsons, and she talked about self-reflection. And she said, I'm teaching students now not to look at, I need this career, but to look at, who am I? How am I wired? What are the gifts I have? What was I created to do? And then a lot of that will fit multiple careers. It looks different ways in different seasons of your life.
Well, you know, I think it's Oprah that said, you know, a lot of people don't recognize opportunity because it looks an awful lot like hard work. You know, and that's another thing I get from your story. As awesome as dreaming is, it is not enough. You have to work harder than anyone else who wants it. There's a great Michelle Obama quote I like. She said, I never cut class. I love getting all A's. I like being smart. I like being on time. I thought being smart was way cooler than anything else in the world. And, you know, I certainly can't say that, but you know, it's not about school. To me, it's about having the commitment to whatever it is you're setting your mind to. Yeah. And you certainly had that. You know, I 1 year, my mother gave me the book Dead Man Walking by Sister Helen Prejean. And as I was reading the book, just the overwhelming thing that came into my mind, I was like, this nun and I would be really good friends. But by the time I was done with the book, I was like, we're going to be really good friends. And a year later, I was sitting in her apartment drinking bourbon with her. And she had designed this program, actually with Pope John Paul, called Moratorium 2000, to work toward a worldwide moratorium. And because we'd had a couple of drinks, I was very comfortable telling her how terrible her plan was, how terrible her fundraising plan was. And she finally looked at me, she said, can you do better? I said, of course I can. She goes, all right, write a salary in for yourself. And I can't say I was that surprised. I mean, when I was reading the book, I just had this sense that this nun and I were going to click. I don't know how the world works, but I think something was set into motion as I was reading that book. And it just made me think about your story. What would you like the listener to take from this, Leslie?
I think, honestly, just really knowing that, like you said, it's okay to take time and dream. I think not everybody has to know exactly what they're going to do with the rest of their life all the time. But I think when you are saying, okay, I know who I am and what I'm created to do, I tell my students now, I probably spent the first time, I'm going to quote Dr. Brené Brown, who's at University of Houston, who I love, but I probably spent the first 19 years of my life hustling for my worth and belonging. And then the last 19 years have been really being free to know that I already belong and I'm already worthy, so that I can help people know that they're worthy and they belong. Because when you're doing what you're supposed to do, it's not about other people. It's about you and you sleeping at night, you having peace. So I think I have lots of students whose parents put a lot of pressure on them to be a certain thing or live a certain way. And it creates a lot of internal conflict that's just not peaceful. And
it's funny you say that, because, you know, I'm lucky to have a lot of young people in my life. And I find the hardest thing for me to do is give them too much career guidance. Because I can tell them the practical and smart thing, but I don't know what's in their heart. And that's something they're discovering on their own. And I would certainly not want to point someone into some path that doesn't speak to their heart. And as kids get older, that's probably one of the biggest challenges I find.
Yeah. And it can feel schizophrenic. You have people who are saying, be passionate, figure out what you're passionate about. And other people that are saying, listen, at the end of the day, you have to pay the bills.
Right.
And how do you find passion that also integrates purpose, that also pays the bills? And that can look really different. But I think if you trust who you know you are and are willing to work really hard at that, it's important. And to know that you're not building a career to make your parents happy. You're not building a life
Absolutely.
To fit in somewhere. You're just building it because you need to live wholehearted.
Absolutely. You know, if the young people in my world are working hard and working with integrity, that's really what matters to me. And that's how I judge if they're a success or not. You know, friends, it is a tragedy that some of the most memorable performances of the world's great talents often fade from the common memory and are lost to future generations. So from time to time, we are featuring storytellers whose lives have ended, but with our help, their stories continue. Tonight, as we are in the midst of the longest government shutdown in our nation's history, it seems appropriate to spend a few minutes with Will Rogers as he discusses Congress and the law. Tatiana, will you play Mr. Rogers for us?
Well, that's received endorsement. It's beyond any expectations that I possibly could think of. You know, there's bills in Congress now to carry on and legalize lotteries. And I received a wire this week from a congressman friend of mine who wants a copy of my plan to read into congressional record. Now, I feel pretty good about that. That's the highest praise that a humorist can have, is to get your stuff into congressional record. Just think, my name will be right in there alongside of Huey Long's and all those other big humorists. And you see, ordinarily, you got to work your way up as a humorist and first get into Congress. And then you work on up into the Senate, and then if your stuff is funny enough, it goes into the congressional record. But for an outsider to get in there as a humorist without having served his apprenticeship in either the House or the Senate, well, I'm not bragging, but by golly, I feel pretty big about it. Did I ever tell you, I don't know whether I did, did I ever tell you about the first time I ever had any of my stuff in that daily? Well, I'd written some fool thing, and it pertained to the bill that they was arguing, or that they was kidding about, rather. So some senator read my little article, and anything that a senator reads goes into the record. So, well, another senator rose and said, you know, and as they always do, if you've ever seen them, does the gentleman yield? They always say that. But they call each other gentlemen in there. But the tone that they put on the word, it would be more appropriate, you know, the way they can say gentlemen, you know what I mean? It would be it'll sound right if he come right out and says, does the coyote from Maine yield? You know what I mean? That's about the way it sounds, you know? And then the man says, I yield, you know? Or if he don't, the other guy'll keep on talking anyhow. And so the coyote from Maine says, I yield to the polecat from Oregon. You know? Well, anyhow. That's the way they do. They're very polite in there. And but I must get back to my story. When this senator read my offering, the other senator said, after all the yielding was all over, and the other senator said, he says, I object to the remarks of a professional joke maker being put into the congressional record. You know, meaning me, see? Taking a dig at me, see? See, they didn't want any outside fella contributing. And, well, he had me wrong. Compared to them, I'm an amateur. And the thing about my jokes is they don't hurt anybody. You can take them or leave them, you know what I mean? But with Congress, every time they make a joke, it's a law. You know? And every time they make a law, it's a joke.
Well, let me ask you, Carissa, what do you think when you listen to that?
Oh, I'm just reminded that comedy is such good medicine, and this kind of political comedy is really good medicine at a time where I often don't know if D.C. is a comedy or a tragedy or both all in the blender at once.
Well, that's exactly why I wanted to play it. How about you, Leslie? What do you think of when you listen to Will Rogers?
Oh, the same thing. Just the simplicity, and I feel like it reminds us that we have kind of gotten away from just being able to sit in a space together and connect with people.
Well said. I also like that this piece was told 85 years ago.
Wow.
But we can relate to it perfectly today. And I think that's what a good storyteller does and a good humorist does. It doesn't really matter whether the story was created in 2019 or 1932. Some things are universal. And I'm hoping that our Congress goes on for at least another 85 years. 85 days, 85 years. This is Greg Audell with engineer Tatiana Gago, and you are enjoying stories about finding yourself with my guest tellers, Leslie Butcher and Reverend Clarissa Baldwin McGinnis on So What's Your Story on Houston's KPFT 90.1 FM, 89.5 in Galveston, and 90.3 in Livingston. Tatiana, got a problem. Our listeners want to know what to expect when it comes to storytelling events in Houston. Can you help solve that problem?
Oh, absolutely, Greg. Let's start with our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild, because it's a great place to learn about the art of telling. They meet the fourth Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. in Temple Emmanuel, located at 1500 Sunset. The next monthly story swap will be on February 26th. The Guild sponsors all sorts of great events, so be sure to visit the Guild's website at www.houstonstorytellers.org for information about all of the great stuff that they do. And while you're checking things out on the Guild's page, listen to some of our past So What's Your Story programs. Every show since 2008, all listed on the menu under radio programs.
Every single one of them.
There are well over 400 of them. Wow.
So
you better get started.
You know, we are actually getting closer and closer to our 500th episode. You'll be hearing more about that down the road, but that is a remarkable achievement for Dr. Rubicek, who created this show.
I completely agree. And if you don't own a radio, that's no problem, because you can listen to us stream live on kpft.org and on our Facebook Live. You can visit us on our So What's Your Story Facebook page and share it with all of your friends. And we'd love it if you'd like us when you leave.
Please like us. Come on.
So What's Your Story is also on YouTube. And come to think of it, we're kind of all over the place. And remember our friends at The Moth at Warehouse Live the second Tuesday of the month, where you'll enjoy dazzling stories and get acquainted with Houston's storytelling community. The next one is Tuesday, February 12th, and the theme is Love Hurts. I guarantee if you like hearing good stories, this will become one of your favorite monthly events.
Thank you, Tatiana. You know, and I just can't say enough good things about both the Moth and the Houston Storytellers Guild. I mean, whether you want to meet interesting people or just have a fun night out, or if you want to develop your professional skills, because there is no profession that will not benefit from improved speaking skills. And I think the Guild is just one. It's not only the best place, it is the place to go in Houston. Whether you're an experienced storyteller or if you're just dipping your toe in the water, you will hear some of the best storytellers in this town. Now, friends, I want to tip my hat to one of my favorite radio hosts, who was also Houston's favorite weatherman throughout my childhood. Doug Johnson died unexpectedly on January 3rd, and though long retired from Channel 2 KPRC, his presence is still felt throughout Houston's airwaves. When I was just out of college and, as was referred to earlier, returned back to Houston, Doug would allow me to sit in on his program and observe him during his three-hour daily radio program. I think it helped that I always bought cheesecake and chocolate chip cookies. Who's going to bar me from the studio with cheesecake and chocolate chip cookies? But he made the show, that 3 hours every single day, sound so completely effortless. And I learned how much work it took to sound effortless. And it is certainly true on this show. And, you know, it takes Dr. Rubicek, who built this show, Tatiana, who runs the engineer, and our guest. But there's a lot going on in an hour program. And Doug was a great example to learn from. I had always hoped to have Doug as a guest on this show, but that wasn't to be. It was because he was the consummate storyteller. It just didn't work out. But I'd like to play a clip of Doug Johnson sharing stories about one of his favorite subjects, and mine, Houston history. Tatiana, will you play Mr. Johnson's clip?
About once a month or so, I like to give you a little progress report on Houston, beginning back in the days when it began. And if you remember some of those stories, it had a rough beginning. But now we're up to, I believe, 1920 to 1929. And it was getting to be a very exciting period around here. In fact, we're getting to a point now where some of you were alive. More of us had parents alive then, and a lot of us had grandparents alive. But from 1920 to 1929 was indeed a very exciting time of this history of Houston. Beginning in 1920, the population of the United States was about 106 million. There were 5 million in Texas and only 138,000 in Houston. But we were on the map because now we're the 45th largest city in the United States. Of course, today we're what, number four? The size of the city was 39 square miles. And bank deposits indicated we were also pretty rich people. The average bank deposit, the per capita bank deposit in Houston, was a little over $600. It was a little under $400 for the rest of the nation. So things were moving along very nicely. Now, there also was a big old bison named Earl that was kept in a gated area, a fenced area, at Sam Houston Park. He became very popular a little bit later on when the zoo opened up. He was the cornerstone of the zoo, lovable old Earl. In 1921, an interesting invention was made by Norman Ricker. He had been born in Galveston, or raised in Galveston, but he lived here in Houston, and he invented the paper cone speaker. It changed the way we hear things. In 1922, we were starting to develop a lot of things, but the first radio station came in. It was WEV. It didn't last very long, but it was the first one. And by the way, in the whole city of Houston in those days, there were only 300 radio sets, so it didn't matter a whole lot, did it? In 1923, we started getting rid of the fire horses and replaced them with fire trucks. My father was 16 years old at the time, and I guess that's the reason that he thought that they were still fire wagons. He always called them that instead of fire trucks. We also, during that same decade, Howard Hughes died. And he left the bulk of his estate to his son, 18 years old, Howard Hughes Jr. He was a student over at Rice. Also, Jeff Davison Hospital opened up, took its first patients. Kincaid School began. The big statue of Sam Houston south of town was unveiled. And then we got, in 1925, the very first radio station that endured. The license was given to KPRC, 950 kilocycles, as they called them in those days. And by the way, the K had to be there, but the PRC was port, rail, and cotton. In 1923, I believe it was, the Majestic Theater opened up. It was a magnificent theater, and a month after the opening, Paderewski, one of the great pianists of the century, performed again in the city of Houston. By the way, I'll give you a story on the Majestic Theater a little bit later on. Also, Alley-Oop, do you remember that in the cartoons? It was born in the oil fields of Texas. V.T. Hamlin was the originator. It was a very popular cartoon for a lot of years. And, of course, as we get to the end of the decade, we have Black Tuesday. So maybe next month we'll talk about the Depression days in the city of Houston. In the meantime, that's Lone Star Lore.
Has there ever been a smoother voice in radio? I mean, I could listen to Doug Johnson all day, every day.
Truly supple. You're right about it.
Do y'all remember him? I don't know if you were here at the time.
I don't. I grew up in the Midwest, so I didn't here till the 2000s.
Well, I'll tell you, I suggest everyone listening lift a glass of their favorite beverage to Doug. I thank him for his generosity of spirit and his kindness to a young guy interested in one day talking on the radio. And I hope one day to be make it as effortless as he did.
Hear, hear.
I'm Greg Audell, and you are listening to So What's Your Story on 90.1 FM KPFT Houston with my guest tellers, Leslie Butcher and Carissa Baldwin-McGinnis. Next week, our guest host will be our friend and our frequent guest, Harwood Taylor. You are not going to want to miss that show. It is always a good time when Harwood is in this chair. Now, Carissa, you have a story, maybe I would say, about being a fish out of water a little bit. Would you share that story with us?
Sure. I think this story is about what I experienced to perhaps be a universal truth that so often when we have experiences of finding ourselves, we find ourselves in the context of relationship with another person or another place or an institution. And so often we have these aha moments when we're outside of our homeland. And that was the case for me in a moment in my 30s. I had entered seminary in 2004, and this was obviously a few years after the 9/11 terrorist attacks. And so here I was being formed to become a public and religious leader for the Christian church with the backdrop of these sort of wars abroad that had really overt religious overtones. And so it felt important to me to come to understand what those were really about and what was underneath them. And because I'm an experiential learner, that means I had to have an experience to understand it. And so, lo and behold, you talk about threads and synchronicities, the dean of my tiny Episcopal seminary at the time happened to have deep personal connections with the Christian Church of Pakistan in the Northwest Frontier Province, right on the border of Afghanistan, which at the time was the heartland of the Taliban. And so I went, and I had 3 weeks hosted by the Church of Pakistan there, where I was particularly trying to look at how do Christians and Muslims relate on the ground outside of kind of what we were seeing in the media about our own global conflict and our public policies and our war policies. And so that was the premise, and several things happened while I was there. One is I was very, very well received and very, very well loved by my hosts, not because of anything about me, but because that's their commitment, that's their culture. You receive the guest, you protect the vulnerable, and to some degree, I think the Christian community there in Northwest Frontier Province, it's a very lonely community. They are small in number. And for them to have someone travel so far just to see them, I think was affirming of their very existence, much less their identity. And so it's really profound to be loved so well by people, even though I had really done nothing to deserve it. It was a healing moment for me, similar to ones I've had traveling to Mexico, to the Philippines, where the culture takes care of people. And the other thing that I learned while I was there is that it's really not hard and it's really not complicated to build bridges between religions or across lines of difference, even in the midst of war. and that is done in very, very simple forms. And so the profound lesson I learned after traveling all that way was you build those kinds of bridges with habits like this. The Christian priests at Christmas would invite the imams to their church to service, and the imams would say yes, and they would bring a Christmas present with them for the clergy and their family. And when it came time to end Ramadan and to put on the Feast of Eid, the clerics would invite the Christian priests to come and to break fast with them. And that is how trust was built, and that's how friendship was maintained, frankly, in the midst of a war that those people had done nothing to foster and create. And I really fell in love with that place because of how well-loved I was and how much it healed me, I think, to be there even for 3 short weeks. And because of the combination of the fact that international relations have not improved much, and also that I took a wife since I was there, I know I can likely never go back. And this has been something that I have grieved very deeply, both as a priest and as a person, for many years. And sometimes it happens that a thread comes full circle and that things are synchronous. And as it turns out, though I may never be able to go back to Pakistan, Pakistan came to me in the form of one of my 3 children. We went through a lot to become parents. And the day that that our first child was brought to our attention, one of the first things we learned about this child was that this child was of Pakistani heritage. And so every day I have my own connection and I have my own way to give back to those who took such good care of me.
Wow, it's amazing. You had no idea when you planted those seeds so long ago what would grow from it or could grow from it.
It's true. We often can't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we can't look too far ahead or it gets awfully blurry, doesn't it?
It's often, I guess we would say in my tradition, when you can follow that thread of your sense of call and when it works out for you, that is pure gift. That is grace. There are so many people who don't have the privilege to follow the thread or for whom there are systemic barriers to things coming full circle. And so, boy, when it does, it tastes really sweet.
Yeah.
And we just receive it as gift.
I think appreciating it is a big part of it.
Agreed.
You know, what a tragedy if you don't see the specialness of it. Well, you know, one of the challenging things about entering the workplace, Leslie, that I was thinking of back when you were talking, is the difference between how we see ourselves versus how others see us. Do you recall a time when you realized that you had a different definition than others had about you?
I think early on, anybody that comes out of college, there was a book that came out when I was in my 20s called The 20-Something Hangover. And it was this, you go from being very idealistic, you have all these people come onto your campus and tell you that you're going to be this professional, you're going to be amazing. And the reality is, as much as I love building bridges, we live in a culture in America where people are trying to climb ladders and you can only start at the bottom. And I remember having moments where I thought, I have a degree and I'm a professional and people treat me like a secretary and that's not who I am. And really having to work through the emotion of, I'm just going to have to do the work. I'm just going to have to earn respect. It doesn't come magically because I have a degree. And I think all 20-somethings walk through that.
Was there a moment when you knew what you wanted to do as an educator, I guess, sometime after the ghostwriting?
I actually probably at 9 years old remember sitting in a Sunday school class thinking that the teacher wasn't using a good metaphor. I know that sounds extreme, but I just thought, I don't think that's what the scripture's saying. And I wanted to argue this theology. I was so upset. And I really did know that there was a better way to explain something. And I did have a moment when I was trying to figure out this idea of moving to California. I had a grandmother who went to college in 1940, which was extremely rare, got a degree in education. And she looked at me and said, if you can, being a teacher is good when you're a mom. And she was probably in her 80s. And I knew that when I was 23, I had a moment where I was really frustrated with my job. I just thought, where's this going? I'm a planner by nature. And I thought, I don't see the end game here. And I remember thinking, I just want to go back to higher education. That's where I felt like I belonged. And so
it felt like home.
It did feel like home. And my husband was transferring to an engineering school, and I applied on a whim for a fellowship, and I got it. And that was the thread I followed in that moment.
I think one great indicator of when you're on the right path is when you don't dread Monday morning, or when you look forward to Monday morning.
Amen.
Yes.
And I've been in that position. Carissa, was the calling to the priesthood, was it like a burning bush moment, or was it a gradual calling?
It was so mundane and spectacular. I was standing at a fax machine. Do you remember those? I was sending a letter in my first job out of college. I was working for a international human rights organization, and I was corresponding by fax with two Roman Catholic priests doing the mundane priestly work of parish ministry, but in the context of a very, very corrupt and brutal regime in collusion with certain oil companies, and really just brutalizing, murdering many of the citizenry. And so these humble priests took it upon themselves to get human rights law training. And they took it upon themselves to start teaching their congregants the laws and what life should really be like. And there at the fax machine, my, you know, rearing in the church just converged with my social justice orientation. And I saw one vocation that was possible that would draw on both and integrate both. And so, no, in spite of the fact that I spent way too many Sundays of my childhood at church, it never occurred to me until that moment.
You know, I didn't expect there to be a burning bush, but I sure as heck didn't expect there to be a buzzing fax machine.
I know you didn't.
That's great. Well, you know, I want to thank Leslie Butcher, Reverend Carissa Baldwin McGinnis, Will Rogers, and our friend Doug Johnson for sharing their stories and themselves with us tonight. And don't you dare move, my friends, because Lars is up next with a sweet mix of singer-songwriters on the Tennyson Tapes. Make 90.1 a part of every day. And while you're driving home, tuning in for the night, or if you're just chilling out, join us each and every Thursday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story? And treasure what you hear. You keep loving great stories, and I promise we'll keep bringing them to you. This is Greg Audell, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that it is absolutely never too late to live happily ever after. Peace, my friends.
If you decided to donate your birthday to KPFT this year, thank you. If your special day hasn't yet arrived, consider donating your birthday to KPFT. Here's how it works. Facebook sends you a prompt before your birthday asking if you'd like to donate your birthday to a nonprofit. Select KPFT as your organization of choice. Then add a personalized message so that your friends know how much KPFT means to you. On your birthday, they'll receive a Facebook notification asking them to make a donation in your honor to KPFT. Thanks again for supporting 90.1 FM KPFT Houston, Pacifica Radio for Peace.
2, KPFT 90.1 FM Houston, and online at kpft.org. Your local station board election is happening. Visit elections.pacifica.org to find out about the candidates, members like you who want to help keep KPFT alive. Look for your ballot starting January 18th via email or postal mail. Vote as soon as you can. Ballots must be received by March 5th. Have questions about your eligibility, the voting process, or need a replacement ballot? Email the National Election Supervisor at NES@Pacifica.org.